pleasure to me as convener of the Economics Department to introduce Paul Krugman. And given the numbers both here and in the other theater, it's quite clear that he needs no introduction from me. Everybody probably is already aware that he is a professor at Princeton University, a regular columnist in the New York Times, and a pathbreaking researcher in the field of international economics. So I thought that instead I'd just tell you one of those rare facts which Paul Krugman doesn't know, which is when I first met Paul Krugman, which was actually at lunch in the cafeteria of Yale University in 1978, when a mutual friend of ours brought us both to lunch, together with a fourth gentleman who proceeded to make an incautious remark in the middle of lunch about the American buildup of armaments expenditure. And unfortunately, Paul had an opinion on this subject. And for every fact that the fourth man put on the table, Paul put two facts, or sometimes three or four. Never have I seen a victim so submerged in facts as this man was. And in the end, he fell completely silent. The only thing I remember about the fourth man is that he subsequently and shortly afterwards left academic life and made lots of money in the New York financial markets. So you see, comparative advantage. I'm going to give the floor to Paul Krugman.
Okay, let's see.
Yes, it works. Technology works. Okay.
This is, I assume that a fair number of people were here last year, and in some ways this is a continuation of that. As has just been explained, my genuine research work is in the field of international, but given the various things I've been involved in, I should say also, in doing international, my big focus tended to be, at least in the more financial part of it, on crises. I was something of an ambulance chaser, looking for countries in trouble. And these days, however, I'm trying to figure out, and if possible, do a little bit to stop what's happening to my own country. And so the general theme, I mean, in a broad sense, has been what the hell is going on. More specifically, the thing that's more or less economistic is how do we understand what's happening with this remarkable shift towards greater inequality and the political economy of it, which is this rather odd fact that in a democratic country with where you would expect the interests of the median voter to be served, we're actually seeing policies that seem to be rather strongly reinforcing that move towards inequality. And this year, we're seeing a fairly serious attack on one of the key pillars of the U.S. welfare state, such as it is. And I'm going to talk about a number of issues surrounding that. There's just the statement of the two points, the political economy puzzle. We have sharply rising inequality combined with policies that seem to be reinforcing that trend. And then the question is, why do the voters, how can this be happening? And there's the big political forecasting question, which is how far can this actually go? Are we really going to see a serious dismantling of the welfare state in the United States? Is that, of course, people would like to know whether something like that can happen elsewhere, but at least for the moment I'm focused on the U.S. issue. I have to say that when I agreed to give a talk on this, the political scene in the United States, the likely outcomes seemed a bit different from where they are now, but that in itself is kind of an interesting story. So let me proceed. Just a little bit of background. This is the story of, if you like, the story of the United States in one picture over the past 90 years. This is the invaluable work of Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez, who have used income tax records together with other sources. You have to have some notion of overall income to produce an estimate of shares of various high-income groups over a very long time period. You cannot get a full distribution because in the early days, relatively few people actually paid income tax. So we don't have the other, we don't have the census data and so on, but this does give you a window. This is the top decile, the top 10%, their share of total income in the economy. And as you can see, it's quite a remarkable story. We had a highly unequal society in terms of income distribution in the 20s and presumably before. But anyway, this is so the first stuff bouncing around there. That's the Great Gatsby era, if you like. And then we had something astonishing happen, which is this huge plunge, which is in the actually Claudia Golden and Robert Margo have called that the Great Compression. It's an extreme narrowing, and it shows up in every other indicator, wage differentials and so on. Enormous collapsing of the income distribution that took place quite specifically during World War II. I mean, it's a politically imposed collapse of the income distribution, leveling off, very sharp decline in the income share of people at the top. And, of course, since that's imposed with wartime controls, everything we know about economics says, well, you know, that's just an artificial thing, and as soon as the controls are lifted, it's going to go away. Everything we know seems to be wrong, because, in fact, it sticks for about 30 years. So somehow we establish, and this is one of the deep research areas, which I'm not really going to get into, but you know, how can that be? What is it? What really determines that inequality? What allowed that compression to stick for so long? And Bob Solow's line was about something else, but it all ends in a blaze of amateur sociology, with a lot of discussion about social norms, but also things like the role of unions, which I will get to later in this talk. And then beginning, crazy thing, we elected an actor president, and something started to happen. After that, I'm not dead sure that this thing is actually is it amplifying enough? Because I know there are people in another room. All right, so we have this remarkable transformation and a full return, pretty much. You know, within the limits of the data, a full return to the Great Gatsby levels of inequality over the space of about 25 years. You'll see there's a little this is without capital gains. So this is not counting, you know, this is not the NASDAQ, at least not in a direct sense. It's not the stock market boom. This is income excluding capital gains. You'll see there is a downturn at the end there. Some of the high income seem to be linked to what's going on in financial markets, even if there is, even if we're not, if we're excluding the things that are explicitly capital gains. From various straws in the wind, I'm quite sure, this only goes up through 2002, that we'll see the line turn up again for 2003 and definitely for 2004, that this was a brief intermission in the upward march and that we're back up on that trend. So a really remarkable change, and we know how it was achieved, we don't know why it stayed so long, and we're not entirely sure why things turned around, but something very, very drastic happened. There's one other thing to say just about the background facts, which is the natural thing to say is, well, decile, you know, that's a fairly wide group. And in fact, many people talk in terms of quintiles. They talk in terms of the top 20%. And then you say, well, okay, look, people, the top quintile, most of them are not what you think of as filthy rich. And you tend to look for explanations of what's happening in terms of things that would affect the upper middle class. You tend to talk about things that would affect people who, you know, increasing premium on college education, increasing premium on skill, technology, globalization. But if you look at this change in income distribution, this is the height of the bar is the share of the top decile. I've chosen 73 and 2000. I could use different dates. It wouldn't be very different. But we divide the top decile into the bottom 9 of the top decile, the next 0.9, and then the top 0.1. And what you see is it's actually quite a modest gain for the 90 through 99. The bulk of the increase is within that top 1%. The majority of the increase at the top 1% is actually going for the top 10th of a percent, which is putting you roughly at this point at the sort of $1 million plus incomes in the United States. So it's a very, very small, it's an extreme concentration or of the gains, at least, for a very tiny economic elite. Something really quite amazing. Again, when I say, you know, return of the Great Gatsby or return of the Gilded Age, I'm not exaggerating. We really are talking about things that are happening very much at the top. Now, we have a majority rule. The simplest model of politics is median voter. And there's a lot of evidence that actually U.S. politics are pretty much one-dimensional now. It used to be that there appeared to be two-dimensional, that race was a big issue, but that's diminished. And it really does seem to be lined up along economic issues, along left-right, in a pretty straightforward way. So you'd expect median voter politics, you'd expect policies to be leaning against this at the very least. You'd expect there to be a pressure to soak the rich in the actual policies. Here's what we actually see in tax policy. Now, this is an estimate from from people at the Internal Revenue Service. That's not an IRS official document. What they're using, now this is federal taxes. It's actually the income tax and the payroll tax, social insurance taxes. There are some other things in there which are harder to allocate, like corporate taxes, but probably wouldn't change the picture. And they've got it for 1979. And when I say post-Bush, what it actually is it's using a 1999 sample of families, but applying tax rates after the two major Bush tax cuts. So it's all put together. What you see is the actual movement of taxes has been, actually, for people in the middle, taxes are slightly higher than they were a quarter century ago. The reason for that is, actually, income taxes are a bit lower, but the social insurance taxes were increased. And for people near the middle, social insurance taxes are larger than the income tax. Actually, there have been a slight increase in taxes quite far up the distribution, even up to this is now the 95th through 99th percentile, slight increase in taxes. So that it's the upper middle class, even the upper middle class by many definitions, is not especially being benefited. But then here we are at the very, very top end. And the top 1% has got about a 9 percentage point fall in the federal tax rate, which is quite a lot. Hard thing to understand politically. Know what? Those of you who were at this lecture last year, I gave a lot of credence, or at least I took very seriously one theory, which says that for a variety of reasons, the median effective voter is a lot higher than the median voter on the income distribution, that it's somebody at the 85th or the 90th percentile. And you could make a case in those circumstances that actually a change in income distribution, an unequalizing change, would actually give, by making the effective median voter more different from the typical person, would actually create an incentive for policies that are further unequalizing. But actually, this even if you think that the effective median voter is somewhere around the 90th or even the 95th percentile, the policies are not especially favoring that person. They're favoring people at the very, very top end of the scale. So it's a pretty remarkable. There will, and this is likely, just a sort of U.S. factoid, this will become more so in the years ahead because of something called the alternative minimum tax, which is a complicated thing, but it tends to fall upon sort of high income but not really high income people, pretty high income, more than 100,000, maybe 200,000, who earned income. A lot of it is not from property, not from investment income, who live in high tax states. In other words, it's sort of a tax that's explicitly targeted on Princeton faculty. And that's going to bind increasingly because the tax turns out to be not indexed for inflation and this whole thing. Notice the tax system turns regressive at the upper tail. You might wonder, how can that be? And the answer is that we also have now a system in which investment income is, certainly for people in higher income brackets, investment income receives a much lower tax rate than earned income. So if you get into the class where you really are clipping coupons and realizing capital gains, then you start to pay lower tax rates. Many people, David K. Johnston, the superb tax expert at the New York Times, believes that there is also, as you go way up the scale, there's a lot of hidden income as well. So the tax system actually becomes quite steeply regressive at the top end. All right, pretty amazing. And there's an economic mystery. How is this? Why is this happening? There's also a political economy mystery. Why aren't people demanding that this change? Why are they voting for this? There are, I would say, there are other things, but I'd say there are three. I really call them theories. There are three stories.
One of them is that the public has been convinced, validly or not, that it's good for everybody to increase the incentives to become rich. Basically, that supply-side economics in some version has actually sold, that people believe that a rising tide raises all boats, and they believe that this is good, that letting the rich grow rich is actually going to raise their incomes. Second possibility is people just don't know what's going on, don't understand it, and are misled. And the third possibility, now this is a book that everybody, certainly everybody who was not too happy with the last election in the United States has been reading now. And it's a book by Tom Frank, who is actually from Kansas, but his theme is Kansas is a state that a century ago was actually had sort of radical politics, populist, soaked the rich politics, and is now a very conservative elects candidates far to the right. And his theme is that they do this, that this has been accomplished by the right because they've managed to switch voters' attention from the economic issues, where they're actually voting against their interests, to cultural, social issues. And I'll talk a bit more about that in a second. But that they've managed to switch it in his view, the economic right is exploiting these cultural issues to get what it wants. Now there's this question about who's using whom, if that's really the story. But I won't get too far into that. The argument is that it's a politics of distraction, of shifting the target to cultural issues. So let me spend a minute on the rising tide economics. And just to say that if you were going to say that people have been convinced of this, and it's possible, there may be some of that out there, you have to say that that's rather in the teeth of the evidence, that that's not what looks like is actually happening. And just the sort of simple chart, this is median family income in constant dollars in logs. And what you see, of course, is that the period of enormous success for the United States was that post-war generation, which is the period when is the period that follows the Great Depression, the period of rather flat income distribution, and that the period of rising inequality has not, median family income has gone up, but at a much slower rate. Now, that's not the same thing as saying causation. And in fact, there's a whole lot of reasons why things turned down after 73. But it's notable, anyway, that in a, just a simple correlation is that when income distribution was relatively equal, you had good solid growth in median family income. And that when it became radically more unequal, you had much flatter growth. And in some ways, it's worse than it looks. In one way, it's better. Families are steadily getting smaller. So in some sense, per capita or adjusted family income has been improving. Congressional Budget Office says adjusts income by the square root of the number of people in the family, which I don't quite understand. But anyway, it looks a little bit better if you do it that way. On the other hand, a lot of this, you do have increased labor force participation and longer work hours for working spouses. So it turns out the gain, such as it is largely longer work hours, that the wages received by people near the middle of the income distribution have actually barely gone up at all. So it's pretty unimpressive. One thing that I thought was kind of interesting is that we talk about the 90s, the Clinton era, as an era of extraordinary prosperity. Even during that period, it's not especially overwhelming for people near middle of the income distribution. It may have been an era of extraordinary prosperity for some, maybe even a fair number of people, but not actually for the typical family. All right. So why, if experience doesn't suggest that people should feel that they're doing better under these policies, why is it happening? And that leads us to the possibility that it is in fact that voter ignorance, that people don't understand what's happening. They don't understand how it works. My Princeton colleague in the politics department, Larry Bartels, has been writing quite a lot on that, using survey data and so on. And it was I actually took this from his paper, though it was actually from a different source originally. I'm sorry. I skipped a step there. completely skipped a step. Let me do that step that I skipped. You might argue, that given that the median family is not the right person to look at. The median family is actually, you should be looking at people further up the income distribution because, again, this, the effective median family is higher up. This is also Larry Bartels, as it happens. He looked at rates of growth under Democratic and Republican administrations, which roughly also happens to match policies that are at least vaguely progressive and vaguely regressive, and came up with this truly remarkable result over the period 48 to 2001, which is fairly robust. Like, you can take Ronald Reagan out of it. It's still there. You can take Jimmy Carter out of it. It's still there. It's surprisingly robust. That basically everybody who is captured by the census data does better during Democratic administrations, up to the 95th percentile. And so if there are people who are doing better under Republican administrations, they're people who are basically not missed by the census figures because of the top coding. They're people who are way up in the stratosphere, which is kind of what the previous data suggested. So it's pretty amazing. So again, there's no simple story about, well, the effective median voter is really at the 85th percentile that will make sense of it. Okay, other Bartels. Voter ignorance. This is from Larry Bartels' paper explaining about the Bush tax cuts. They do show The Simpsons here at least sometimes, right? So this is the actual title of Larry's paper is Homer Gets a Tax Cut. What he has is extensive data, polling data, survey data, various kinds, that shows that basically when it comes to tax cuts, people do not make the connection between tax cuts and government programs. They do not make the connection that a tax cut is going to require eventually that some government program they like might be cut. They also do not have a sense of income distribution of where the taxes fall. The most remarkable case of that is the largely successful effort to get rid of the estate tax in the United States. And to a remarkable extent, that's a popular cause. People believe that the estate tax must be eliminated because I want to be able to leave my money to my kids. And this is in spite of the fact that very few people actually pay it because there is a very large exemption. It's an extremely regressive tax cut, if you like, but people don't get it. You can get away with it in political campaigns with amazing stuff. There were some ads that were run successfully against the former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle, which showed a barber complaining to his customers that he might not be able to leave all of his business to his children because of the estate tax. And if you know about the exemption limits for the United States, you know that was some barbershop. Now the thing to say is this is bad to make it Homer Simpson, because the fact is that it's not just that if you're you're Homer Simpson, that you don't understand what's going on. It's actually extremely hard for most people who aren't policy wonks, who aren't, you know, sitting down to, who don't actually derive pleasure from going through estimates of tax impacts, to understand what the content of policies really is, because it's just not there. And there is an issue about media and all of that. In the 2004 election, it was not a campaign that was fought very explicitly on distributional issues, but to the extent that there was a major domestic policy difference between the two candidates, it was on health care. And it was a clearly distributionally oriented difference between the two candidates. The Bush plan for health care revolves around the creation of tax-sheltered savings accounts coupled with high-deductible health plans, basically to encourage people to set aside money and use less insurance. And given the way marginal tax rates work, and given the fact that these things had to be tied to high deductible plans, which posed too much risk for most people, it amounted to creating a tax shelter for high income families. The Kerry plan called for repeal of the very highest end of the Bush tax cuts, and using the revenue to finance a very limited amount of national health insurance, catastrophic health insurance, plus expansion of some of the other programs. So it was not large sums really involved, but it was clearly one candidate was proposing a something that would further increase inequality, and one was proposing something that would at least slightly compress inequality. Would voters have known that? Well, I actually did some homework at one point during the campaign. I went through transcripts of news programs from television from the three major broadcast networks and the three cable news networks in the United States. I went through 60 days to discover if during that period there had been anything that would have allowed someone who got their news from TV to understand the contrast between the plans. And the answer was no, not once. There were a couple of reports about the rival health plans, but they were all in the form of horse race reporting, how the plans are playing, but they never actually told you what was in the plans. So actually there would have been no way for the great majority of people do get their news from TV, or if they read newspapers as quickly, there would have been no way that anyone would have understood what was actually at stake in the policies. Now, the third thing is what's the matter with Kansas, the use of cultural and social issues. Although it's actually not in the book, but it becomes apparent, national security-related issues. And so the argument was that basically people who are following economic policies that appear to be quite inimical to middle-income working families nonetheless win elections because they manage to convince those families that only they or only their party will defend them against gay married terrorists. Now, actually, you think I'm being silly. The big issue since the election has been the push to privatize Social Security. Now, of course, that's not the word. It's just a side point. It's, privatization is the term comes from the advocates of creating a system of individual accounts. And in 1997, the Cato Institute, which is kind of intellectual headquarters for this, created something called the Project on Social Security Privatization, which had conferences and meetings and wined and dined members of Congress and so on. But in 2002, Republican strategists discovered that privatization polled badly as a word. So it was revoked as a word, and the instructions went out not only not to use the word, but to accuse anyone from the news media who used the word of falling for Democratic slander. And the Cato Institute changed the name of its project from the Project on Social Security Privatization to the Project on Social Security Choice. What was interesting was they didn't announce we are changing the name of the project. They simply changed it and they scrubbed the website so that unless you looked a little bit hard, it appeared that it had always been called the Project on Social Security Choice. They even went back and changed the minutes of old conferences so that it appeared that it had been called Orwell Lives. Anyway, Social Security privatization, the Bush, we've never had a full explicit plan, but the general outlines have been clear. It's a combination of allowing people to divert a portion of what the social insurance taxes into personal private accounts. That's not free. When you do that, essentially you have to mortgage your guaranteed benefits from the plan at a real interest rate of 3% is what we think we learned. So that your future guaranteed benefits would be cut if you did that. And then coupled with a reduction in the replacement rate from the guaranteed benefits, even if you don't, to the private account. So it was a scaling back of benefits plus the opportunity of mortgaging. And if you work through the arithmetic on what we thought was the plan, and we never actually did get a full plan, within a few decades you would have largely converted Social Security, the retirement program, into a defined contribution rather than a defined benefit system. So it really would have shifted it completely to individual investments and individuals bearing the risk. The social insurance aspect would be largely gone. Become a forced saving plan rather than a social insurance plan. Now AARP, the seniors organization, came out against it. A little more language stuff. AARP used to stand for the American Association of Retired Persons. These days, AARP insists that it is not an abbreviation. They are just AARP. It doesn't stand for anything. But anyway, when AARP endorsed AARP opposed. They basically joined the opposition to this plan. The 501c3s, the nonpartisan but effectively partisan, never mind, U.S. election law, but the essentially the same people who did the attacks on Kerry's military record during the campaign, then were rolled out to go after the AARP, and they began running ads like this one. The AARP is against the troops and in favor of gay marriage. And they actually managed to find, there were two bills that the AARP, one that it supported, one that it opposed, that turned out by a very a great stretch of the imagination could be construed as being against the troops and in favor of gay marriage. Didn't fly very well, but it really, I mean, it's, so I'm not actually joking. It really is that raw. In general, a lot of things about the U.S. Are pretty raw and hard to believe these days. Okay. So along came this Social Security privatization. So, okay, Bush won the election. The Republican majority in the Senate enlarged. And now came the possibility of the real assault on the welfare state institutions. Just to go back, you know, that great compression that takes place in the income distribution is also the period when the United States develops a large part of the welfare state, Social Security, unemployment insurance, and then later on, during that period, we get the rest of it. Basically, the three key programs for the United States are Social Security, which is a retirement and disability program, Medicare, which is more or less universal single-payer coverage, but only if you're 65 or older, and Medicaid, which is means-tested healthcare assistance. So those are the three big programs. And there's been this push to go after Social Security, to convert it into a system of private investment accounts, one way or another. And in December of last year, after the election, with everyone prepared now, this is going to be the big push. The administration did launch its campaign to sell the conversion of Social Security into a system of private accounts. A few things to say about how that started. I think in general, everybody, myself included, thought that it was an unstoppable juggernaut. First of all, just, you know, they had won on so many other things, and they had won the election, and even though it was a narrow win, it was being treated by most people as if it had been a landslide. The media were extremely sympathetic to the project of privatizing Social Security. You would get, for example, you'd get on the morning, the breakfast shows, you would get people from the Cato Institute being put on to explain the problems of Social Security and the gains from privatization, not as a debate, but simply as these are the experts, and here they can tell you what it's going to be. And so they launched it, and I think, you know, widespread expectation that at the very best this was going to be a really desperate political struggle for those who were trying to save it. So a couple of polling charts. People were asked whether you want to allow put some of your money in private investment, and whether you'd like to leave Social Security basically as it is. And as of, December of last year, people did in general, there was not a majority, but there was a plurality in favor of private investment accounts. And then as the campaign to sell Social Security privatization went along, roles reversed. And by May, there was a clear plurality against any major change in the system. These things depend very much on the exact wording of the question, so it's really the trends rather than the levels. But this actually goes back during the 2000 campaign. Bush talked about Social Security private accounts and got a quite favorable response. Of course, there wasn't a whole lot of discussion about how it would actually work at that time. By 2003, 2004. There was more skepticism, but still, again, this sort of plurality of support. And it didn't seem to be looking too good. It was going the wrong way in the first few months of 2005. At that point, Bush went on a 60-day road tour of town hall presentations, intensive campaigning for it. I think I'm not sure if the tour ever officially ended. It certainly went into at least 80 days, but anyway, it kept on going. And you see the results of Bush touring on support of Social Security privatization. And he basically has been talking less about it, and so it's been getting a little bit, gaining a little ground. All right. Now, I'd like to say that this is all about the brilliance, rhetorical and analytic brilliance of the people who were opposed to this. And what is true, I will say that the one thing that was kind of interesting and a little bit surprising and gratifying is that is how unprepared the privatizers were to actually deal with this issue. That they you had people who basically had their entire working careers devoted to developing rationales for privatization at places like at the right-wing think tanks, and then when they had their moment, and people asked some questions like, "Well, okay, how are you going to handle disability benefits?" Because Social Security in the United States, although it's primarily a retirement system, it's actually to an important degree also a disability insurance system. And well, they hadn't actually figured that one out. How are you going to deal with, you're assuming very high rates of return on equities, but you're also assuming that the U.S. economy's growth is going to slow quite a lot because of demographics, and also price-equity ratios are much higher than they were historically. How does that all fit together? Well, they hadn't actually thought about that. And the big thing was going to be your Social Security benefits will be heritable, but they were also going to require most people to convert their Social Security private accounts into an annuity on retirement. And well, but then how is it heritable? And they hadn't quite, it was really quite amazing. It gave you an impression of the disadvantages of having a kind of hothouse intellectual environment isolated from debate with opposing views. They were not really ready at all for the arguments. However, the main thing was that people like Social Security. And although what I think I had misunderstood, along with everybody else, was that Bush could win on tax cuts because people didn't really understand how that might hurt them. But when he does a salt on a popular, very important, one of the key pillars of the welfare state, people said, hey, I like that. Interestingly, it appears that actually states that voted for Bush were, if anything, more hostile to this idea than those that did not, because they tend, on average, to be somewhat poorer, which is another story. But it really does suggest that the What's the Matter with Kansas story is a large part of this. The people basically thought they were voting for someone who would keep them safe from gay married terrorists. And then along it comes and says, now my first priority is to privatize Social Security. And their sort of reaction was, what? What's that about? And so what the evidence actually does suggest, and this is this is what we've learned. Now, not for sure. You never know. They might pull something out. But the evidence does suggest that actually, even now, even after all of this, even after the historical realignment and the 55 Republicans in the Senate and all of that, it's still, you can't do that. You cannot fundamentally, in an open way, undermine Social Security. And let me say that Medicare, which is not yet as big a program as Social Security, but will be because of the way medical costs go, Medicare would be even harder. Just could not, I don't think, go after that in any very direct way. Medicaid as a means-tested programs are more vulnerable always because there are, there are poor people and often even non-white poor people who benefit from them, and that makes it a little easier to attack them in the United States. But actually, there's a fair bit of backlash even against attempts to cut those, so that the frontal assaults don't seem to work. And that I was not sure. I didn't know that. I was actually expecting this frontal assault to succeed back in December, but it appears that it has not gone anywhere. It appears that it's actually going to just sort of be allowed to drift off. Does that mean that actually the whole project of dismantling the welfare state to sort of solidify this victory of growing inequality is a non-starter? And the answer, I think, is no. And this is where, so the question is, can you dismantle the welfare state by saying, we think this is all bad stuff? Probably no. Can you, however, do a lot at the edges? And the answer is probably yes. And at the edges can be pretty fundamental. That's especially true. The U.S. System, it's not the we've always relied for the social insurance net actually as much on private institutions, although buttressed with government policies that encourage them, as on public. So, of course, we have no national health care system. We have no national health insurance. We've relied upon a system of employer-based private health insurance for most non-elderly Americans. That system depends a lot on government policies that favor it. And so you can make a big difference if the government policy ceases to favor it quite so much, and that sort of thing. Let me just talk for a few minutes about examples of the kinds of things that can be done even though people say they like the welfare state institutions. First, there are policies that are that don't require, basically require you not doing something in order to make the to undermine the institution, rather than requiring you to actually do something. The classic case is the minimum wage. We have minimum wage. It's set in nominal terms. It has to be raised by a vote of Congress every time it gets raised. And it's a lot easier. I don't think anyone could get away with abolishing the minimum wage, but allowing it to dwindle, well, this is the history of the minimum wage relative to the, now the non-supervisory wage, that's the wage of, you know, of non-managerial workers average across the United States. And so it, in some ways it understates this, the extent of the decline, because we've seen much bigger income increases further up the scale. So it has been possible during this long period of political support for growing inequality, you might say, for the minimum wage to gradually dwindle in its effectiveness. Not perfectly. You know, there's a fairly big boost under that socialist George Bush the Elder, and another one in the late Clinton years, but it's still something that's been allowed to dwindle away. A more subtle example of the same thing is unemployment insurance. Now, the U.S. unemployment dole is a very thin protection. It's not so much that the benefits aren't generous, although they aren't especially, but it's the duration. It's complicated because it varies across the states, but it's typically, at best, it's 26 weeks of coverage. Now, there is, however, an unwritten rule that when you do have a severe, sustained economic downturn, it gets extended. So we have an extension of unemployment benefits. It becomes something more like a traditional Western European unemployment support in practice, in times when the economy is having a downturn. But that has to be voted. That has to happen. It requires a positive action. And so here's the story of what happened during the most recent cycle. Early 2002, under enormous public pressure, Congress did, in fact, extend the unemployment benefits. But at the end of 2003, Congress said, well, the economy's recovering, all done, no need. What I'm actually showing here is this is the average weeks of unemployment. So the average weeks that a person on the unemployment, considered unemployed, has been unemployed. This in itself is a bit of an economic puzzle. Why is the duration of unemployment staying so high? The unemployment rate is now at a pretty normal level historically. A lot of things I could talk about there, why I don't really believe it, but the duration has remained very, very high. And so they allowed it to lapse at a point when long-term unemployment was actually a much more severe problem than it was when they passed the extension of benefits, and has remained so. So this is, again, this is a fairly serious erosion of a pretty key social insurance program, unemployment insurance, that was allowed to happen. It does show you can do quite a lot. The other thing you can say is that there are, because we depend on these private institutions to provide a lot of welfare state, you can change the rules, encourage changes. There's a long story, which I think I shouldn't try to talk about, which is the, there's been, what the Bush administration is trying to do to Social Security has happened to private pensions on a massive scale. We've had a wholesale shift from defined defined benefits pension plans to defined contribution plans, which is in part the result of government policies which have essentially encouraged that. And it has had the effect of shifting risk from corporations to individuals. We've had a fairly serious and accelerating decline in employer-based health coverage. And that's that's partially the result of government policies, although it's and would be much more so. One of the effects of these various Bush health policy reforms would be to reduce the incentive for employers to offer coverage to their workers. So that's another example. And there's this broader sense that the environment in which private sector decisions are made can be shaped over time by government policies that reinforce or weaken institutions that might promote equality. And the big question, the dramatic thing for the United States is simply the fraction of workers covered by unions. And as you see, it's dwindled. A lot of that's in the public sector. Private sector unionization is really pretty minimal now. And that is, at least in part, government policies, active attempts to undermine unions, as opposed to, there's a great rise in unionization under the New Deal, which was the result of active government encouragement, and had a lot to do, I think, with why the Great Compression actually stuck for so long. And this decline is surely an important part of the reason why the income distribution has sprung apart again. This is just about here is a date that it's the Ronald Reagan firing all the members of the PATCO, the Air Traffic Controllers Union. So there's kind of a symbolic turning point, which is associated with that big downturn. Where are we going? Pretty amazing. I think I should say one thing. Why are they doing all of this? You know, if the median voter, maybe the median voter can be fooled, but the median voter is certainly not gaining. Why are the politicians doing all of this? And I'm sorry to say, I think the answer has to be money. It ends up being pretty raw, pretty crude. Certainly campaign contributions, but it may be going beyond that. We're actually, now we're starting to see a whole lot of stories bubbling up of sort of personal enrichment by politicians, of politicians by business interests. It's pretty raw, it's pretty crude. And the point is, but of course the point is they can get away with it. That has always been an incentive. It's always been clear that a defense contractor, if a defense contractor could bribe a politician to throw it a big contract, it would. And it has happened. And even, certainly the life history of Lyndon Johnson is nothing make you think that Democrats are immune from this. But it appears to be a particularly accelerating at this point. So what happens? And I'll just talk about three ways it could go. One is that starving the beast is the conservative doctrine, which says that what you do is you cut taxes so the revenue base for the welfare state is not there, and then you can slash away at the welfare state by basically pleading government poverty. And that if you can do that, if you can eliminate the welfare state institutions or sharply shrink them, you also eliminate the constituency. Very, very strong view that there's path dependence, that if you have welfare state institutions, people like them and they survive, but if you can do away with them, that they, then people won't demand them back. Spearing the beast was the phrase coined for Social Security. This was not going to, you're just going to try and really get it one of the key welfare state institutions and make it go away. And again, people wouldn't demand it back. It's looking a lot harder for that to happen after what we've seen with Social Security. Now, I may be making too much of just 6 months I'm sort of surprised and maybe a little giddy at actually winning one for once, but it doesn't look as if this works as well as they thought. There's mostly this chipping away at the edges. People say, "Hey, I'm a median voter, and this is against my interests," and you get the popular backlash and a new deal, or Reconstruction, national health insurance. Like to see that, as you can tell. I've been reading a lot, talking a lot to Larry Bartels now, and he has some papers on what moves elections, and they are, I have to say, they basically suggest that attitude of almost complete cynicism is pretty nearly exactly correct. that elections hinge on what's happened to the economy in a few months before the actual election date, that even the New Deal was really just that Roosevelt had good luck with the business cycle. So maybe it comes, but it's hard to know. The interesting thing now for the United States is that they have done the tax cuts and appear to be unable to actually do the dismantling of major welfare state institutions. And that way eventually leads you to some kind of fiscal crisis. You really have the irresistible force of tax cuts meeting the immovable object of the great welfare state programs. And people say, well, you know, neither side will give in. And that, I guess maybe that leads from fiscal crisis back to the popular backlash, though maybe for the wrong reasons. It's a pretty amazing story. Again, it's sort of hard to believe that we got here. I think if you'd asked 20 years ago, we thought that we'd all achieved a sort of consensus about, you know, rough consensus 25 years ago about how we were going to run modern advanced economies and how we were going to, not have punitive equalizing policies, but also have a pretty strong social safety net. And that turns out to be wrong. It turns out that really radical changes can and are happening, but we don't know how it all plays out. What we do know is that this is not the end of the story, because we have tax policies that only are possible if you really do get big cuts in the welfare state programs. And the first really major effort to go after after one of the key welfare state programs, began, I thought, as tragedy and seems to be ending as farce. So it's not going anywhere. Probably know a bit more next year.
With that, let me bring this to a close. Thanks.
Questions, but given that we have just 10 minutes for
questions, I'm sorry about that.
I would like to ask people to try to keep the questions short and to the point so we can fit in a few people. Starting here.
Let's just one question about, I know that you didn't say anything about the European case, but I think that's the good counterfactual. What will be your advice to Europeans where we are trying to dismantle exactly the welfare states? Because we think, or some voices say, that it is exactly, it has a quite negative effect on GDP growth, on unemployment rates. And do you think that the U.S. Public opinion would accept an unemployment rate of 27%, like we had in some European countries just 10 years ago?
Oh, gosh. I'm not sure I can answer all of that. My read is that it's not necessarily the size of the welfare state as the sort of intelligence of it that matters. I mean, it's actually quite remarkable how sustainable Sweden has turned out to be once they did some fixes. It really is, the unemployment rate is not very high. It's still an incredibly generous welfare state, but it doesn't seem to be. There was much glee among U.S. conservatives in the early 90s when Sweden seemed to be in deep crisis, and they're quite disappointed that it still seems to be there. In Germany, I become an ugly American saying you're overregulated and have too much, too few incentives. Let me just say, I do believe that the European problem is macroeconomic demand policy issues, not just structural. This would be a whole different talk, but it's very sad to see the problems of the euro playing out exactly the way that ugly Americans warned 10 years ago they would, and I think that is a much bigger factor. And sorry, last point, long answer to only part of your question. When people say, well, you need to have structural reform so you can have the flexibility so that wages can adjust in the single currency area, nobody has that much flexibility. The United States doesn't have that much flexibility. We run a single currency area because we have extremely high labor mobility among regions. Even with all the brutality of the U.S. system, wages are not strongly flexible downward.
Next question. Right up at the top there at the back.
You've made the point that, particularly with the trade unions and, of course, other things, that have come along as well, that, that job security is not as strong as it was. Could the answer to the puzzle of the behavior of the median voter be that they've been sold the story, or bought the story perhaps, that unless people in the very top level are paid huge amounts of money, that there simply won't be enough jobs because there won't be the incentive to run the economy efficiently?
I think to some extent people have been sold that. I think that people, you know, believe it, although I think a large part of it is that they have no idea, really, about what sums we're talking about. That is, I even find that professional colleagues are surprised to find out how high incomes are in the top tenth of a percent. But yeah, people have to some extent been sold. And, you know, there is a lot of, there's a fairly elaborate propaganda machinery there may be some truth to it, right? Incentives do matter. There's quite a lot of propaganda machinery as well. I guess I should mention, for example, when I talk about the tax system having gotten regressive at the top end and much less progressive than it used to be, how many people know that? If you were reading watching Fox News, if you were reading the Wall Street Journal editorial page, what would you know? I can actually tell you this. I'm just going to do something here. This thing. The Wall Street Journal editorial page actually trumpeted a study which it said showed that the U.S. tax system has become more progressive because the rich are paying a higher share of taxes. It was this study. It was this same study. They simply pointed at, in fact, the top tenth of a percent are paying a higher share of total federal taxes than they did in 1979, entirely because they've had a much higher share of income. In fact, their tax rate has fallen, but the Wall Street Journal just didn't mention that part of the paper. I think it's a mix of stuff. And the main thing is most people are not paying a lot of attention. I'm really thankful to George Bush for choosing Social Security as an issue, because this is something that people really did understand what was at stake. For the most part, they don't, and that's a large part of how this can happen.
There's another question up at the top.
So a place where people could go to, non-policy wonks could go to get this information, was the open-ed pages of the New York Times. Correct me if I'm wrong, come September, they're no longer going to be free and accessible. I'd like to know your opinion on that. And it's doubly ironic that your colleague Thomas Friedman, who's been espousing chapters and chapters on open source.
Not my decision. however, I think I can... I believe if you wait a day maximum, unless they get much more aggressive than I think they will dare, the stuff will escape from behind the paywall and be found someplace. I'm not happy, they did not call me in and say, we have this idea. They called me to say, by the way, in September, you're going behind a paywall. Sorry. You can also just actually buy the paper, although I guess that's a little hard. Or you can pay a small fee. That's what I should say. As a loyal Timesman, I should say, subscribe to the damn thing. It's a good source.
So the day it goes private, there's a website going online, keepkrugmanfree.org.
Okay. On the other hand, my position at the Times is possibly slightly, I get a little more security once I become a profit center. So. Yeah.
There's another question right at the back here.
Thank you very much. One of the great features of American society and the success of American economy has been the social mobility, which has significantly fallen over the last 20, 30 years. I think there has been a lot of empirical evidence that has proven that since 1978, the level of social mobility, which is basically the ability of people to rise through the society based on their education and competence rather than their family connection, has fallen down. So my question to you is, on one level, is social mobility important for a society or for an economy, given the fact that if the rich people are working already very hard to maintain the higher level of to be at the top? So if they're working hard themselves, do you need people to go through the society in order to give the country a competitive advantage? And the other thing is, what kind of economic policies can be introduced to increase social mobility in the society?
Okay. Oh boy, I think that's more than I can ask. But let me just talk about the first part. The social mobility is, we think it's down, and it's of course, the great American myth is that we have this enormous and mobile society, but the studies actually show that we're in the bottom of the league tables among advanced countries now. It's depending on the study, the United States is at the bottom of the league tables, or it shares the bottom social mobility with Britain. And the reason is pretty clear. It's whatever we may think about the classlessness of our mores, that's trumped by the fact that lots of people just can't get access to decent education, can't afford to go to college, have poor health care, all those things that tend to keep people at the bottom. And the policies, suppose that your goal was to turn America into a dynastic society, pretty much inherited position. You'd eliminate the estate tax. You'd arrange for tax rates on investment income to be substantially lower than tax rates on earned income. You do something that looks an awful lot like the set of policies that are actually being followed. Do the people at the very top work that hard? You have to stop thinking about Princeton professors at the 97th percentile as being the beneficiaries of this policy. We are actually, really is up there at the very, very top. And some of that is corporate CEOs who are working very hard, although probably in socially counterproductive ways. And some of it, a fairly significant part, is Paris Hilton. So this is I don't think this is good.
We have another question at the back here.
I guess much in the same vein, I couldn't help but realize that many of the gains made in the stock market over the last 20 years especially fall into pretty much the same time period as all your graphs start and your charts start taking a turn for the worse. I was wondering if you had any comment on that, and maybe the old what's good for GM is good for the U.S. kind of bad advertising.
It does coincide roughly with the period of big stock market gains. It's not, by the way, the figures are that do not include those. I mean, we've excluded the capital gains, but it is a period of rising profits. We do have the labor share of GDP put this way, the after-tax corporate profits share of GDP is now at its highest level since 1929. Think about what that might imply, but anyway, we have so there has been I spent many years saying whatever else is happening to the U.S. income distribution, it's not a labor versus capital thing, but in the last 4 years it has become a labor versus capital thing as well. So it really is a shift. But by the way, just to tell you, to give you a sense of how much the society has changed from that relatively egalitarian period, the guy from General Motors did not say, "What is good for General Motors is good for America." What he actually said is, "I believe that what is good for America is good for General Motors, and vice versa." But the first, it was this kind of communitarian spirit, General Motors in the 1960s was by modern standards like a fairly radical socialist republic. I mean, it really had much more level distribution of income. Even the janitors, the cafeteria workers were paid well, and that this is not the kind of society we are anymore.
Our two final questions are both right here at the back.
Sorry.
What role, if any, do you think corporate misgovernance, such as Enron, has played in the greater inequality of wealth in the States, which I think you said has particularly benefited 0.1% of the population?
I actually believe it's probably the other way around, that the causation runs from the greater inequality to the malfeasance rather than. I'm not sure what share of the high earnings of CEOs is of top executives is the result of bad accounting, but I think what happened is that the extraordinary rewards that top executives can get from the appearance of good performance for over a quite short period is what really, more than anything else, drove the epidemic of corporate malfeasance. It's if you were CEO of a large American corporation in 1968, and you were earning about 40 times what your average employee made, if you cooked the books to make the company look better, you might get a bonus, and for 1 year you would earn 43 times what your average employee made, and then you'd be out the door when it got discovered, and just not or you would be if it's not worth taking. But if you are in the modern world where your stock options will allow you, during the period between the time that you begin cooking the books and the time that the whole thing collapses, allow you to walk away with $200 million, the incentives are quite different. And I think that's the story. And you have to bear in mind that most of the players in the Enron story will probably walk off quite wealthy men with nothing save embarrassment. And that's probably not an issue that's very big with them anyway.
Am I right in thinking there was one last question back? Yes, right. Last question.
Yes, excuse me. Just picking up the GM theme that was mentioned before, of course, GM is in trouble now.
Yes.
And one of the, I guess, ways out is to reduce the worker benefits. Do you think this is going to be a trend that not only are we going to see public welfare benefits squeezed, but also private welfare benefits?
Oh, it's already happening. It's tends to be done in indirect ways. So growing numbers of workers are on a temporary status; they don't get the full benefits. Or the company health plan. There's still a health plan for everybody, but the deductibles have gone up and the contributions have gone up. Or the retiree benefits are slashed, which is easier to do. And of course, also the companies that are really bloody-minded about how they treat their workers tend to do well, and those that are not do badly. So the Walmarts expand, and the GMs are in deep trouble. What's interesting, actually, something I have not quite figured out. I sort of understand, but in 2002, I think the General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, and the Auto Workers Union sent a letter to the government extolling the virtues of national health care. The government of Canada, that is, where all three of them operate. And they explained at length in this joint letter what an important thing it is to have this national single-payer health care system and how you mustn't ever do anything to tamper with it. But they have not been able to bring themselves to say, actually, we'd like that here in the United States too, even though the arguments would be exactly identical. So there may come, I should say, maybe one way in which we get this new deal is not so much the vast popular backlash as the remaining big corporations from the era of relative equality saying, hey, we want some more of a welfare state. But I don't know if they'll ever have the nerve to do that.
I have had strict instructions to ask everyone to allow me 30 seconds to bring Paul out to speak to some gentlemen of the press before everyone leaves, and to tell everyone that there are two receptions, one out in the atrium and the other one up in the Shaw Library. And I hope if you have further questions for Paul, you'll save them for the reception. And I hope you'll join me in thanking Paul for another wonderful talk.
Thank you.